Good to have all of you on our study tonight at the book of Revelation. We're going to be in the 14th chapter as we pursue our study. As we continue our study in the 14th chapter of the book of Revelation, context, context, context. Have any of you ever heard that before? It's so important to our study of this book. We know in the 11th chapter where things are pointed. We know in the first several chapters. In fact, in chapters 2 and 3, you get a feel for where things are pointed as you read concerning the seven churches of Asia Minor, the problems that existed in the churches that typifies similar problems that might exist in any church. And as you come to the 11th chapter, you see a scene of victory. You see the 24 elders that are before the throne of God, and they're worshiping him, giving thanks for his greatness. Sounds very similar to chapters 4 and 5, as we saw there in that study. So you know where this battle, this engagement is going. You know what's going to happen. You know the victory of the saints. But then behind the scenes, we're presented chapters 12 going forward that tell us what is the cause of all the difficulty that the saints are having. And we see the woman and the child, the son of the woman, the man child that's discussed in verse 5, presented. And then we see this war, this battle that is described beginning in verse 7 in heaven. Michael and the archangel go forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred with his angels. The great dragons identified for us in verse 9 as the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. So this paints the backdrop against which all of these other things that we've been studying, chapters 1 through 11, have taken place. Now, we noticed in the 6th chapter of our study, beginning in verse 9, the cries of those souls that were beneath the altar that had been martyred for the cause of Christ. And they're crying out, how long, oh God, is this going to be? And they're assured that in a little while, this will end and the vindication will then indeed take place. Now, in our text, in the 12th, 13th, and 14th chapters, that constitutes a segment of the context that we're studying, and we want to continue with those chapters together. In the 13th chapter, we're introduced to the beast that came out of the sea. And the beast that came out of the sea was authorized by the dragon, which we know is the serpent. Most believe that the sea beast is Rome, and we've talked about that in some detail. I think you find the comparison between Revelation chapter 13, the beast is like a leopard, feet were like a bear, and so forth, very similar to the description of the fourth beast of Daniel in Daniel chapter 7. And we've relied heavily on Daniel chapter 7 to be the exposition of Revelation, the book of Revelation. And I think that's an accurate way to go on that. Daniel is telling us here's what's going to happen as he's describing that fourth empire of Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Here's what's going to happen. It's going to be destroyed. Now, John is coming along more close to the time when all of that is to be fulfilled, saying, now here's what's going to happen. This sea beast came forth and made war with the saints, verse 7. And all that dwell on the earth shall worship him, and everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that hath been slain. So John continues to record the ongoing battle between the devil, the Roman Empire, that I believe is described here concerning this beast of the sea. But then we're introduced into the 11th verse to another beast, the beast that came up out of the earth. And then it's described and it received its authority from the first beast. And we talked about that in our study of that, to note that here were those who represented the false prophet, false religion, paganism, those who were called upon to validate or enforce emperor worship during this time. And then we looked at verse 16, 17, and 18 of the 13th chapter, and we talked about those who received the mark of the beast, that they would be able to buy and sell, and this would constitute their livelihood. But if you didn't have the mark of the beast, then you couldn't participate in those things, and thus the torment or the difficulty, persecution that these Christians would have. Now, in verse 18, the writer says of chapter 13, here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Well, there are those who say that this number 666 is identifying a specific man. I'm not confident that that's true. I think it's just a number that's used to indicate any man. And when you worship any man, whether it be the Roman emperor, or whether it be the Pope in Rome, or whether it be George Washington, as we use that to illustrate in an earlier study, it doesn't make any difference. You're coming up short of perfection. It's not going to do for you what you think that it will. It might gain for you some peace in this life, but ultimately you'll die and you'll face the everlasting judge, and you'll face everlasting torment. And that's where he goes in the 14th chapter. And I think that when we study the 13th and 14th chapter and we stop at the last verse of chapter 13, we stop short of the context. The context is chapter 12, 13, and 14. And the vision that John saw was of this beast that enabled people to survive, gave them the authority to buy and sell and so forth if they would worship the image of the beast. But that's not all that John saw. In chapter 14, he saw, and behold, the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his name, the name of his Father, written on their foreheads. Now, the question that we want to pursue in the 14th chapter as our study of this segment of Scripture continues is, what choice now do you really have? Are we presented with a viable choice, whether we worship the beast and receive his mark that would enable us to buy and sell and have our livelihood in this life, or whether we receive the mark of the Lamb and of his Father and are numbered with the 144,000, those who are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb? And the choice is yours. Now, regarding those who worship the beast, we want to note in verse 8, it says that he saw another angel followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, that hath made all the nations to drink of the wrath, a wine of the wrath of her fornication. And another in verse 9, angel the third, followed them, saying with a great voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receiveth a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night. And they that worship the beast in his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of his name. And he says, herein then is the patience of the saints, that they keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. Now, what's going to happen to the beast that has issued the mark, so to speak? Well, he's not going to survive. Now, question, what did Daniel say that would happen to that fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7? Look at verse 11, Daniel chapter 7, verse 11. What would happen to that beast that Daniel is describing? Well, it would be burned. I'm sorry?
It was slain.
It would be slain. Yes, that's right. Let's look at it. Daniel chapter 7 at verse 11. Daniel chapter 7, verse 11. I beheld even till the beast was slain and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire. And as for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Now, the thing that I find more than just a coincidence is, as John continues to write in the book of Revelation, what does he say that's going to happen to this beast? Well, in our text of Revelation chapter 13 and 14, we know that it's going to be destroyed. But as you look further into Revelation chapter 19 and pick up the reading at verse 19, John writes, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse, against his army. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought the signs in his sight, wherewith he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. And the two were cast alive into the lake of fire and brimstone, that burneth with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword of him that sat on the horse, even the sword which came forth out of his mouth. And all the birds were filled with their flesh." Now, what does John say is going to happen not only to the beast, but those that worship the beast? What's going to happen to it? Well, it's going to be destroyed, going to be burned with fire. Isn't that simple? And we see that not only in the text of Daniel. We see it in the text of Revelation 14. We see it in the text of Revelation 19. Just as Daniel said, now John says here, it's coming. So that's the ultimate end. Now, if you worship the beast, that's what's going to happen to you. Now, what if you don't worship the beast? What if you don't worship the beast? You say, "I won't do that. I won't receive the mark of the beast on my forehead. I won't be enabled to buy and sell, to be able to engage in profitable business enterprise. I might lose my home. I might even lose my life. But what will you gain?" John writes, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works follow with them." I want to suggest to you, beloved, that this is a profound text. We've sometimes used it, and I often do when I'm preaching a funeral, but that's not the purpose of this text, just to comfort family who's lost a loved one. The purpose of this text is to set a contrast. You can worship the beast. Here's what you got. You might live now. You might live another 10, 15, 20 years. But when you die, you're going to be tormented day and night forever. There won't be any rest. What if you don't worship the beast? Well, you might die. But if you continue being faithful to the Lord, then you die blessed in the Lord from henceforth, and your works do follow with them. Now, that becomes the subject matter that's dealt with from this point going forward. Those who die in the Lord receive the blessings of the Lord. They'll have rest from their labors. Their deeds do follow with them. Now, I'm persuaded that's exactly what Peter was describing in 2 Peter 1 when he talks about those attributes that we sometimes refer to as the Christian virtues or graces. They shall be supplied richly, entrance into the eternal kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, here's the contrast. Which one would you choose? Based on this context of Revelation 14, you want to worship the beast in his image and be tormented day and night forever? Or do you want to continue to worship the Lord and receive the mark of the Lord and receive these blessings and rest and the privilege of your works following with you? Now, I just put them side by side on this chart, and I think it makes sense to me. In Revelation 8 through 12, the man is cursed who worshiped the beast in his image. He'll drink of the wrath of God just like the beast does. Unmixed, there won't be any diluting. He'll receive full strength of the wrath of God. There won't be anything held back. He'll be tormented day and night with fire and brimstone. The smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever. They have no rest. Now, you compare that over on this side to those who continue to serve the Lord and keep the commandments of God and the faith in Jesus Christ, continue to exercise patience. Now, which one would be your choice? Now, question, do you see how this would be so beneficial and so encouraging if you were a Christian during this time of such intense persecution where you might lose your life? Now, I want to pause just there. I sometimes get going and fail to give you a chance to ask a question or make a comment. Any questions or comments on anything we've said so far? Randy?
Yeah, I was just thinking about there's a class of people who don't fit into either category, you know, people who aren't emperor worshipers, but they're also not Christ worshipers. Specifically, the Jews who refused to believe that Jesus was the Messiah, they wouldn't worship the emperor either, but they certainly will be thrown in with those.
Yes, good point. Simply because they're not keeping the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ, verse 12.
Right.
Yeah, so they would be objects of the wrath of God too. I think you see evidence of that, frankly, just to make a comparison between the Jews and the Gentiles. We see what the Gentiles, who were so evil and corrupt in Romans chapter 1, were doing. And then you pursue that into Romans chapter 2. Now we've got the Jew. And then in Romans chapter 3, the question is asked, does the Jew have any advantage over the Gentile? Well, he did. He had the law and the promises that were contained in the law. But the fact is that he continued to commit sin, and so consequently he would be subject to the wrath of God just as the pagan would, the pagan idolater. He would be subject to the wrath of God, and that's what's introduced in Romans chapter 1.
And I was just going to say the same would hold true for atheists and everybody else who refuses to worship anything or anyone.
A question, isn't that a rude awakening?
Yeah.
Here are good people claim they worship God, but they're not doing what he says. And they're cast together in the same category with the idolater. Maybe that would fit well with Revelation 21 verse 8. But for the fearful, the unbelieving, so forth, it labels you all together. There's no separation of kinds of sins. So good observation, Randy. Excellent point. Any other comments or questions? But what we want to note beginning in verse 14, this is a kind of a follow up on what we've been talking about, but nonetheless, the subject matter or paragraph, I guess, would change. John writes in verse 14, and I saw, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud I saw one sitting like unto a son of man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the temple, crying with a great voice to him that sat on the cloud, send forth thy sickle and reap, for the hour to reap is come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud cast his sickle upon the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now, this is really interesting to me when we look at the context once again. When John said, I saw and behold a white cloud, and him that sat on the cloud was like unto a son of man. Who was sitting on the cloud? Who was it in Revelation 1 verse 7 was going to come and all would see him come with the clouds or come on the clouds? Well, that's the son, the one like unto the son of man. As you'll turn back again to Daniel chapter 7. And look there in verses 13 and 14, Daniel said, and I saw in the night visions, and behold, there came one with the clouds of heaven, one like unto the Son of Man. And he came even unto the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and the kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away. And his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. Now, friends, the text of Daniel chapter 7 is contrasting the nature of the kingdom of the one who came to the Ancient of Days and received the kingdom, the nature of that kingdom to the kingdoms of men. What would happen to that fourth kingdom that Daniel is describing in Daniel 2, Daniel 7? Well, it wouldn't last. All these kingdoms of men would be destroyed. But what about this kingdom? Well, it will never be destroyed. Now, whose kingdom is it? Who is it that was likened to the Son of Man that came into the Ancient of Days? That's who John is seeing in Revelation chapter 14. Well, we know that's the Son of God. And who was it that he came to? Who's the Ancient of Days? Who was it that gave him the kingdom? Well, that would be his father. And so as we identify the text, it's clear that John in Revelation 14 is identifying the same scene that Daniel had identified in Daniel chapter 7. Do we see that? Any questions or thoughts or comments further on that? Well, look, if you will, as he continues into verse 15, he said, and another angel came out from the temple, crying with a great voice to him that sat on the cloud, send forth thy sickle and reap, for the hour to reap is come, for the harvest of the earth is reaped. And he that sat on the cloud cast his sickle upon the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now, we know about harvesting, reaping. We read about that in a number of texts, both Old and New Testament. And what we're seeing here is a reaping that takes place. In this instance, we're going to be talking about the reaping from the viewpoint of those who are righteous. Now let's notice, I think this is crucial. This reaping that we're talking about is not the final judgment. It's not the judgment scene that's presented for us in Matthew chapter 25, the AD 70 people notwithstanding. Matthew 25 is talking about the final judgment. But when we look at the text of Revelation, I don't believe he's talking about the judgment, the final judgment. And we can talk about the judgment of God upon the city of Jerusalem. Jesus talked about that in Matthew chapter 24, but that's not what John's talking about. John's talking about a judgment against Babylon, a judgment against Rome. Now, when that judgment would take place, there would be two elements of it. There would be the viewpoint from those who are righteous. What would be the benefit of the harvest to those who are righteous? When this reaping takes place, what would benefit the righteous? Would it be a grand day of victory for them, would it not? It would be a day of vindication. Their prayers from under the altar from Revelation 6, beginning in verse 9, would begin to be answered when they would see Rome fall. Their tormentors be no more. It would be the execution of God's wrath. In many respects, it would be a joyous occasion of deliverance for them. Notice, if you will, that the one sitting on the cloud had a golden crown, a sharp sickle, like unto the Son of Man. We've talked about that. So seeing this from the viewpoint of the righteous, it would be a gathering together of the righteous ones. Well, we see evidence of that in the gospel accounts. Look, if you will, at Matthew chapter 3. In Matthew chapter 3, reading beginning in verse 12. There the writer says, verse 12. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod. That's not the passage. That's chapter 2. No wonder. Verse 12. It says, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly cleanse his threshing floor, and he will gather his wheat into the garner, but the chaff he will be burned up with unquenchable fire. Well, that's what you do, isn't it? The scene of reaping is one that these people who would read this would be familiar with. Well, we're familiar with that. I remember when we lived, actually, in this part of the country, where I am tonight, when people would harvest their wheat. When they were through doing that, they would combine the wheat, and the combine would throw the chaff out behind it. And then the stalks that were left standing, when the farmer was through, he would come right behind that and set it on fire, burn the field down, because he had harvested the wheat. And you would see a 200-acre wheat field on fire. It looked like something terrible. But what was he doing? He was preparing the soil then to plant soybeans. That would be the next crop come along behind it. But he had harvested the wheat. That was a gathering the wheat into the barn. What do you do with the chaff? You burn that. It's destroyed. And that's the scene that's presented here in Matthew chapter 3. The good part would be salvaged. So from the standpoint of the righteous, they would be salvaged, if you please. They would be rewarded. But from the standpoint of the wicked, the chaff, they would be burned up. And that's the scene that's presented in Matthew 9 and John chapter 4. And we want to see that as we see it presented here in the book of Revelation. So here would be a good time, as it were, for those who are righteous. Judgment has occurred. Vindication has occurred. But now, what if you were not one who kept the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ, as we see in verse 12. Well, he pursues that. Another angel came out from the temple, which is in heaven. He also having a sharp sickle. And what did he do? It says, another angel came from the altar, and he hath power over fire. And he called with a great voice to him that hath the sharp sickle, saying, send forth thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. We've got something taking place here in verse 18, don't we? In verse 18 and then on into 19 and 20, we've got another kind of reaping taking place. We're not gathering to gather the good stuff. We're getting rid of the chaff. We're getting rid of the vine, the part that needs to be destroyed. And I think that's the scene that is presented here in verse 19. And the angel cast his sickle into the earth and gathered the vintage of the earth and cast it into the wine press, the great wine press of the wrath of God. Now, do you see judgment taking place here upon those who are not doing good things? Here are those who are worshiping the beast in his image. They're not doing good things. And so consequently, the day of God's wrath was not a good day for them. It was a day of judgment that would be pronounced upon them. Now, this verse has become somewhat controversial in verse 20. And the wine press was trodden without the city, and there came out blood from the wine press, even unto the bridles of the horses, as far as 1,600 furlongs. That's an interesting text, like I said, for many reasons. But what we're getting to see here is what John is presenting in picture form of what it means for those who are wicked in verse 17 through verse 20. And as he describes that, here's an angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven. And what did he do? When he cast in his sickle, he gathered the grapes and put them into the wine press of the wrath of God. Now, what's the image here? What happens to the grapes that are placed into the wine press? They're smashed and squeezed, and then the juice runs out of the wine press. Now, the language that is used here, I think it's important, and certainly so as we look at Old Testament language that is very similar, sometimes exact to this. And we see, again, the judgment scene of God presented. Look, if you will, in the Old Testament prophecy of Joel. We'll turn back to that, to Joel chapter 3, and let's pick up the reading there at verse 9. Again, context is so very important. In verse 9, he says, "Proclaim ye this among the nations. Prepare war. Stir up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Haste ye and come, all ye nations round about, and gather yourselves together. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Jehovah. Let the nations bestir themselves and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the nations round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread ye, for the wine press is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great." In verse 14, he said, "Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of Jehovah is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining, and Jehovah will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the earth, heavens and the earth shall shake. But Jehovah will be a refuge unto his people and a stronghold to the children of Israel. So shall ye know that I am Jehovah, your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall be, or shall no stranger pass through her any more." Now, we know in the reading just simply of this text that Joel is talking about a restoration of Israel to the land. But what we want to know is that though his blessings are pronounced upon Israel, what would happen to the nations there beginning in verse 9? Well, they would be cast into the wine press, and they would be subject to the wrath of God. Now, that's exactly the same language that John is using in our text as he presents the judgment of Rome. Now, we think, well, you know, he was talking about the nations over there in Joel. And so how do we know that he's talking about Rome in the book of Revelation? Because that's the subject that's been introduced in chapter 13. And that's the scene that continues into chapter 14. As you turn back into your Old Testament, once again, to the book of Isaiah, you'll read in Isaiah chapter 63, as we have that on the board, beginning in verse 1, a very similar use of language that describes judgment, but this time it's not on the nations as a whole, it's on the nation of Edom. In Isaiah chapter 63, look beginning in verse 1, he said, "Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah, this that is glorious in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength, I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thine garments like him that treadeth in the wine vat? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was no man with me. Yea, I trod them in mine anger, and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my wrath it upheld me. And I trod down the peoples in mine anger, and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. Notice that Isaiah, he's not talking about the nations as a whole. He's talking about Edom, and he's using exactly the same language that John is using, exactly the same language that Joel used. If you want to read in Lamentation chapter 1, you'll find another judgment presented that uses similar language describing God's judgment upon his people, Judah. This is judgment language. Now, somebody will read in Revelation chapter 14, and they come out of verse 20 with some kind of a literal image of judgment. And that's not what John is presenting. Look at how he describes it. He said, the wine press was trodden without the city, and there came out blood from the wine press, even unto the bridles of the horses, as far as 1,600 furlongs. I understand that's 200 miles. Now, those of you that have been in our Bible study of the history and geography of the Bible, we've described approximately the length of the whole land of Palestine, and we've noted that it's not hardly 200 miles. The width of it, of course, it varies, but average, somewhere in the neighborhood, maybe about 75 miles. But John is not describing something that is precisely going to take place in literal Jerusalem or in literal Palestine, going to have literal blood flowing up to the horses' bridles. We know that the land of Palestine itself is varied as far as the topography of the land. We've got mountains up in the northern part, Mount Hermon, that would be elevation of about 10,000 feet. Then you've got sea level on the coast, and you've got two mountain ranges, one on each side of the Dead Sea. You've got one of the lowest points, or the lowest point on the earth, as you consider the Dead Sea. And so what do we have? We don't have a place in a physical, literal land where blood would flow to the horse's bridles. You don't have a place like that. But what is he describing? He's describing the horror of God's judgment upon those who would be subject to his wrath. And so it was. Another angel came out of heaven, and he thrust his sickle in, and here's what he did. And so we read of that. I want to note this expression because some have questions about it, ideas about it. They were trampled without the city. The question is sometimes asked, well, what city? Some then take the position, well, we're talking about the literal city of Jerusalem. Keep in mind that John is writing in signs and symbols. I don't believe he's identifying a particular city, a literal city, where this judgment would take place at all. Any more than he's talking about a literal wine press or literal blood that would flow 200 miles and up to the horse's bridles. This is not a literal picture, and it's not a literal city. Here's a quotation that I found that some of you might find interesting. I know this man, Arthur Ogden. His daddy preached in Barwalla, Kentucky, where I grew up, went to church forever. I know Arthur Ogden. I knew him. He's passed away now. I don't agree with his position on this, but I don't, as somebody said, I don't fall out with him over it. I just don't believe that he's got this slice just right. The Romans, he said, trod upon Jerusalem from the outside of the city as their weapons of war constantly bombarded its inhabitants with arrows, darts, and stones until every drop of blood within it was removed. The language is symbolic, yet it conforms somewhat to the literal descriptions given by Josephus of the destruction of the city. Well, that's what he has to say in his commentary. I think that the destruction of any ancient city that you read about would be similar as far as how it was destroyed. Why did they put walls around cities? And why did folks stop putting walls around cities? Well, they put a wall around the city so that those who were inside the city would be protected. And what did their enemies do? Not just the city of Jerusalem. Though Josephus describes it in great magnitude, and perhaps there was never anything like it before or after, that's what the Lord said in Matthew 24 as he was describing the fall of Jerusalem. But that's how ancient cities were destroyed. They would bombard the walls with stones. They would shoot arrows over the walls into the cities. They would catapult dead bodies, diseased bodies into the city. And we think that germ warfare is something new. No, that's what they did back then. That's how they would destroy the cities. And they would put an army around the city. And yes, that's exactly how Rome destroyed the city of Jerusalem. But that's exactly the military tactics that were used during the time. Now, when did such tactics become useless? For those of you who are historians, you know that with the inventions of gunpowder, they were able to blow up those walls around the city. So the walls weren't important anymore. They wouldn't protect the inhabitants of the cities. That's why the city of Los Angeles don't just build a wall around it. You see, you can't protect a city or its inhabitants by the building of a wall like that. We've got the kind of weapons that would destroy such a wall. So I think his argument, it presents an argument that was peculiar to the time. Yes, that was how that city was destroyed. That's how all cities were destroyed during that time of history. Now, another fellow that you'll recognize his name regarding what city, Brother Haley offers this interpretation. He thinks it's the heavenly city of Jerusalem that is being discussed. Well, obviously, we know that we're not talking about a literal war that took place. We're not talking about a literal city that was destroyed. We're not talking about outside of the literal perimeter of a city. Some say, well, we know that Jerusalem had a wall around it. Yes, it did. And we know that Jesus was taken outside of the city wall, and there he was crucified on the Golgotha. Well, all that's true, but that doesn't provide evidence that that's what John is talking about here. All we're talking about here in this text is a judgment that took place. Brother Haley makes this comment, and I must concur that this is true. Whether that be heavenly Jerusalem or not. But he said, as the bodies of the sin offerings were burned outside of the camp, and as the sin offering Jesus suffered without the gate, and we can read that in Hebrews 13. So it is appropriate that the world that rejected him and his salvation should be trodden without the city. The blood which came out of the wine press under the depth, reaching the horses' bridles and extending as far as 1,600 furlongs, about 200 miles, is quite difficult to explain. Indeed, especially when you take a literal approach to the text. Literalism is ruled out by the whole picture. The old physical Jerusalem is not the city of the vision. And the area of Palestine is the lake. One cannot interpret the picture literally because that territory is not 200 miles long or wide. Also, the low depth of 1,290 feet below sea level at the Dead Sea makes any literal interpretation impossible. Probably the picture intends to indicate the magnitude and completeness of the judgment. Now, how can you argue with that? We're not talking about a literal city that was destroyed. We're not talking about a literal physical place that this destruction took place. We're talking about the fall of an empire. No longer profitable to worship the image or to worship the beast. Now, what we want to note is they gathered the clusters and cast them into the winepress of the Almighty. What I want us to take home, the point I want us to learn, is we're not talking about two judgments. If you talk to the premillennialist or the futurist, he's got the resurrection of the righteous and the judgment of God there, the reaping of them. And then 1,000 years later, we've got this great battle of Armageddon where the wicked then are destroyed. Well, John is not talking about two judgments. He's talking about a single judgment that would serve two purposes. The single judgment would vindicate the saints, be a position of reward for them, but it would also be a curse upon those who were worshiping the beast or upon the beast. Now, these came out of the altar. Verse 18, this angel came out from the altar. That's interesting because where were the saints when they cried out for vindication? Well, they cried out from under the altar, saying, how long, O God, is this going to last? I don't believe that these saints were under a literal altar. So to make more of that than what's stated is unwarranted. He's simply talking about the prayers of the saints would be answered. The judgment of God would satisfy what these saints were crying for. And so heaven's judgment against Rome would be severe. We notice in the 13th chapter, verse 1 and verse 11, that the treading of the winepress of God's wrath is upon those who are the subject of this context. And I don't believe that we can identify with certainty that we're talking about Jerusalem. That's not the subject of the context. The subject of the context is verse 13 or chapter 13, 1 and chapter 13, 11, the Roman Empire and the provincial kings and Roman paganism, the concilia that enforced emperor worship. They would be the subjects of God's wrath. So this destruction would await those who would oppose God's people. Now beyond that, that's about all I know to say about that. Maybe you've got something to add to it, but I want to notice this, but kind of wind this toward a conclusion. In these chapters, we're introduced to six angels. We've got four, what I've called from time to time, great banners that are being presented. You'll notice in the 14th chapter, in verse 1, John saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion with all the redeemed, the 144,000. And then in verse 8, he saw a second angel, fallen is Babylon the Great. And then a third angel in verse 9, if any man worships the beast, then he's going to be subject to the wrath of God too. But then the fourth presentation in verse 13 is, here's what God said to those who were righteous. Blessed are those the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their works do follow them. So four great, what we'll call banners, two sickles of judgments that are discussed there, beginning in verse 14. The wicked and the righteous have two totally different futures. The judgment is a reaping for those who are righteous and a blessing to them, a cause of vindication for them. But for the wicked, it's a day of punishment, not a good day for those who are wicked. Now, the consequences are stated in this context for both groups. Good for the righteous, bad for the wicked. And so that's the image that God has presented for us through John in these three chapters. Now, which one would you choose? Here it's summarized. Chapter 12 describes a battle with Satan. Chapter 13 describes Rome falling. We see two beasts, the empire and the Roman concilia, paganism, as it were, the false prophet, falling. Chapter 14, a picture of victory for God and for his people. Now, I think that's relatively simple. Now, it may involve some complications and some disagreements, of course, among brethren. But the thing that I want us to see is, here's the contrast. Which side do you want to be on? That's not a hard choice, is it? You can worship the beast in his image and be subject to the wrath of God, have no rest day and night forever and ever, or you can be blessed in the Lord. You might live now, worship the beast, but you'll die eternally. There won't be any end to it if you do that. Now, you might serve the Lord, you might die now, but then you'll be blessed forever and your works will follow with you. Now, that's all I had to say about that. And I don't know where I am on the clock, Richard. Looks like about 15 minutes till. 5 minutes. Okay, that don't give me much time. I want to pause just here before I introduce some things from the 15th chapter, if we have time to do that. Do you have any questions or any comments? Any thoughts? Randy Childs, go ahead.
We were just sitting here supposing, now he's predicting, prophesying the fall of Rome. Historically, that didn't happen until 476. I mean, that's what generally is assumed, around 476. But it was encouraging, I guess, to the first century Christians to know that it's gonna fall.
Yeah.
He didn't have to specify when, just the fact that it's going to. But the second century Christians had the same book, and the third century Christians, and the 21st century Christians, we have the same book. So we're not necessarily encouraged because of the fall of Rome, but we also are encouraged because it doesn't matter what government you're under. You don't worship the government. You don't worship the leaders that are called to lead you. But we worship God. We're members of we're citizens of a kingdom that will not be destroyed.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Isn't that profound? And I think that's what Daniel was pointing to. Daniel 7 has just been remarkably helpful to me in this study. And I think that's exactly what Daniel was pointing to. And John is calling their attention to those images from Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 2. And what would that do for you in first century times, second century times, or 21st century times? God does what he says. Time don't change the promises of God. Don't change it. Now, there's all kinds of applications of that. When you look at the promises that he made to Israel to destroy them if they worshiped the idols, that's what he did. Mm-hmm. He took them captive. And he prophesied that in Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30 and told them that when you repent and return to him, he'll bless you. He'll bring you back into this land. What did he do? He just did exactly what he said he'd do. Now, should Daniel 7 be any exception? No, he always does what he says he'll do. Any other comments or questions? Well, let me pause here, and I'm going to change gears just a little bit because chapter 15 and 16, I don't have time to go into chapter 15 much, but maybe I can introduce it and make that beneficial for what little time that we have remaining. Put this on the screen. Chapter 15 kind of constitutes the beginning of an interlude. Now, we've talked about that word before. It's kind of a boxed in parentheses of time. And that's what chapter 15 does. Now, here's a summation. If I was teaching this just starting with this chapter, we'd summarize that. But we've already done that. And here's where we are in chapter 15 and chapter 16. We're talking about the bowls of wrath. Here's the war, chapters 12 through 14 that we've just talked about. And here's how the rest of the book of Revelation is going to break down for us. And we'll see that as we go along. But in chapter 15, we're told about seven angels with seven plagues of wrath in verse 1. We're introduced to the victorious saints on the sea of glass. Lots to be said about that. And those who overcome in the beginning of that chapter. And what are they doing? This is going to be the focal point of the 15th chapter. When we get into this text in chapter 15, verses 2 on through verse 4, we're going to see them doing just what we saw them doing in chapter 4 and chapter 5, singing praises unto God and the Lamb for their greatness and the victory that we see there. In verses 5 through 8, we're told about the seven bowls of wrath that were given to the seven angels, and we're going to be reading about the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. Now, let's just read a little bit, maybe the first four verses, and that'll get us introduced to what the 15th and 16th chapter is going to be about. In verses 1 through 4, it says, "And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having seven plagues, which are the last. For in them is finished the wrath of God. And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that come off victorious from the beast and from his image and from the number of his name, standing by the sea of glass, having harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord God, the Almighty, righteous and true are thy ways. Thou King of the ages, who shall not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy, for all the nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been manifest," in other passages, "unto them." So what we want to note is that in the 15th chapter, we see all of these who are redeemed singing a new song. And they're singing the song of Moses and the Lamb. Those of you that know me know that I like to sing the song that's in our book called The New Song. And it reflects some of the words of this passage. As we see, the wrath of God then is finished, and they're singing songs of victory unto God. Now, I'm going to stop sharing these screens because I don't want to get us too far into this study, and I certainly don't want to get my thoughts off track. I'm easy to do that this time of day. But you'll notice again the presentation of victory to these Christians, a grand occasion for them. Now, in the 16th chapter, we're going to read about the pouring out of these bowls of wrath, a wrath of judgment upon the earth and the sea and the rivers and the sun, the throne of the beast and several things, as we'll discuss that as we go along. And we'll be talking about Babylon, the great harlot, and that becomes a subject matter that's in these next few chapters. So I'm going to stop there and once again raise the opportunity for you to ask a question or to make a comment before we close our study. Any comments or questions?
I'm sorry, Nick. Hey.
Yeah.
What was the, I was trying to write down what you said about the review of chapter 13, 14, and 12, 13, and 14. What was 13? Something
13
about
was, yes, 13 is discussing the beast coming up out of the sea. I'm persuaded that that's Rome. And the reason that I'm persuaded of that is you compare the language of Revelation 13 in verse 2 and 3, well, verse 2 in particular, to the Old Testament text of Daniel chapter 7, and you see the imagery is almost identical. So is he talking about the same thing? I'm persuaded that he is. And when you go back to that Old Testament text, he's talking about Rome. We know that because he's talking about the fourth empire. And you see that sequence of empires beginning with King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2. And the fourth empire would then indeed be Rome. And that's what John is talking about in chapter 13. Now in chapter 13, verse 11, we noted there that there was another beast coming out of the earth, and this seems to be those who had the authority given to them by the beast to enforce emperor worship. And that was a problem for early Christians in the Roman Empire. The Roman emperors, some of them in particular, some to a worse degree than others, demanded worship. And if you didn't worship them, according to the text of chapter 13, then you could be executed. And that's what they did. Now, I don't know. We haven't drawn too vivid of pictures of the kind of persecution that saints endured during first century times. I'm told in some of my reading that it wasn't uncommon that Christians became the lights in the courts of the kings during their festive parties. They would take somebody that was a Christian who would not bow down before the beast and worship the emperor. And they would dip them in pitch and tie them to a pole and set them on fire. And they would light up the courts of the emperors during their festive parties. Now, if you were a Christian and you saw a fellow Christian enduring that kind of persecution because of his faith, would it make you think twice about denying the emperor his worship? Maybe you would compromise and say, I believe I can take a pinch of incense and burn it one time a year to worship the emperor. Because after all, I know that that's nothing. Well, no, you can't do that. You can't compromise your faith like that. But that's the kind of thing that some of these folks were enduring.
That's right. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah. Tragic, isn't it?
It is. It's horrible.
Just horrible. Yeah. Aren't you thankful that you don't live during that kind of persecution? We think things are bad. I heard a fellow back some time ago say things are worse than they've ever been. No, I don't believe that's so. I don't know of any Christian. I've known Christians that have been persecuted because of their faith, but I don't know of anybody that suffered like that. Now, some of you earlier were talking about if you were a Christian today in China, that it would be difficult. That's probably right. I don't know if it'd be quite like what these folks were enduring, but you would likely suffer some persecution. There are places in this world where the preaching of the gospel is not welcomed.
I remember hearing a few years back about some Christians who were told to either pledge allegiance to Allah or something, or they'd be beheaded.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were beheaded, you know?
Yeah. What would you do?
Yeah.
See, the emphasis. Yeah.
Yeah.
The emphasis of John is here, you might lose your life, but then what? Blessed are those who die in the Lord from henceforth.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's just what happens. Any other comments or questions? Before we close our study, as we always do, we want to invite anyone that might be a part of our class to obey the gospel. Maybe I'm talking to somebody that would like to contact some of us and we can help you to become a Christian. There won't be any good decision in your life that will be any greater than that one. It's so important. Perhaps you've obeyed the gospel and you're not living the kind of life that you know you should. You need to repent of that and ask God's forgiveness. If we can help you with that, then make that known.